for a bird strike. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
A Dutch man accused of plotting to kill American troops in Iraq is expected to plead guilty today in the first such case to be tried in the U.S. Prosecutors say Wassam al-Dulaima, who was born in Iraq, was seen on video helping other insurgents plant roadside bombs. Dulaima initially claimed he was forced to make the video after being kidnapped and threatened with death. The 36-year-old was extradited from the Netherlands 2 years ago. Here's an update from Wall Street. Dow Jones Industrial Average up 63 points at 7,334. NASDAQ is up nearly 6 at 1,431. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming Cirque Elwaz, Nebbia. On March 3rd and 4th, they return to Champaign-Urbana with acrobatics and theatrics in the third part of the Sky Trilogy. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
And good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of our program, we'll be talking about the national economic crisis, what it means for the Illinois economy, trying to talk a little bit about which way the indicators point, and talk about how state government has met the challenge of the recession, or maybe has not met the challenge of the recession. Also try to consider what is now a very significant mismatch between state revenues and the cost of state government. And we have two guests with us on the program. Both of them are economists at the University of Illinois, Fred Gertz and Richard Dye. And also would like to mention that both of them have contributed to a publication that is just recently out from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs of the University of Illinois. This is the Illinois Report 2009. And they've been doing that now every year for several years. There are chapters that look at economic issues, infrastructure, education, and the policy implications of all of those things. If you're interested in reading this, you can do that by going to the website of the Institute, or you can get a copy, an actual printed copy from them. Either way, go to the website of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and you can find out all about it. Questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So whether you are here in Champaign-Urbana or whether it would be a long-distance call, either way, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we say hello to Fred Gertz, who is here in studio with us.
Thank you.
Thank
Good
you
to
very
be here.
Much for being with us. And also joining us here on the telephone is Professor Dye, Richard Dye. Professor Dye, hello.
Hi.
Thanks.
Good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. And we can pass things back and forth here, and we'll see what kind of things are on the mind of callers. Just as a way of trying to open up here to talk about where we are, economically speaking, clearly we are in a deep recession, and we know now that we have been since, I guess, the end of 2007, and that economists say we don't know when this is going to end. You know, some people are saying, well, maybe we'll get a better idea in July or in December or sometime next year. Let me just turn here to Fred Gertz, who's sitting in the studio with me. What do you think? And is there any way to answer that question? How is this going to play out.
Right. It can be answered, but no one really knows at this point. It would be just speculation at this point. If you go back a year ago, most of us were saying that we're going to have a slowdown in the economy. We hope there won't be a recession. So a year ago, we were hoping to avoid the recession. A few months after that, we thought there might be a recession, but it would be a mild recession. And now the next step was maybe it will be a deeper recession, maybe as deep as 1980, but certainly no worse than that. And now most of us are hoping it's no worse than 1980, and we avoid a really precipitous kind of downturn. So things really have changed. And it's really a kind of a dual crisis or a dual set of problems. The first problem is a recession that comes along every so often, recently about every 10 years or so. But then overlaid on top of that is the financial crisis that's been going on for some time, but really reached a head back in October and late September and October of last year. So this is not a normal recession. It's a serious recession that's made much more difficult and much more dangerous by the financial problems that go on top of that. And we really haven't had a financial situation like this since the 1930s. We've made some headway, but it seems like we never quite get it solved. And unfortunately, even though President Obama can reassure the public, he doesn't seem to be able to reassure the markets mm-hmm. in the same degree. And the most obvious case of that was several weeks ago, the Secretary of the Treasury, Geithner, went out to explain the way we're going to deal with the crisis, and the market dropped precipitously during his explanation. So there's a lack of confidence about exactly where we're going, especially in terms of the financial crisis.
Well, just for a second here, and then I want to get Richard Dye in here, just to talk about the response to Secretary Geithner. I think that some of the response was people felt that his plan, the plan they laid out, was pretty short on details. That is, he really wasn't saying what they were going to do. But that also makes me wonder, well, even if they had been more detailed, right. would the markets have been any happier, right. or would they just have found plenty of stuff to be unhappy with no matter what?
Yeah, there's a lot to worry about. And I talk about another crisis. There's a crisis in the economy. There's also a crisis among economics economic analysts and economists, because what we thought we knew a year ago, we don't know today. If you'd asked me a year ago, will we have a recession? I'd say, sure, those are possible, but it'll be a mild one. We can control it very well. There'll never be anything like the Great Depression. We certainly have the tools and the techniques to deal with that. And so we're in a situation now where we don't exactly know how we got here, how the crisis occurred. And as a consequence, we don't know exactly how to deal with it. We know we have to deal with it. We know we don't want to have something happen like the 1930s where the banking system collapses. So we know our goal. We don't know exactly what the blueprint is to get to that goal. So it's really a difficult situation. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the final complicating factor is that there's a difference of opinion about the stimulus package. Not everyone believes that the stimulus package is going to be as effective as President Obama hopes it will be. So a lot of issues here, and it's not surprising that the markets are not exactly certain about where we're going right now.
Well, let me bring Richard Dye into the conversation and give you a chance to weigh in on the same sort of questions, particularly this question about where we are in this right now and how long maybe we might expect things to play out, or at least before we get some point where we feel like, okay, things are, we've turned a corner, you know.
We just don't know, and it's the coincidence of financial crisis of confidence and ordinary things that contribute to a downturn. Ordinary downturns, things get overbuilt, some sector goes bad, whatever. That's the type of recession and normal cleansing of the business process that we know how to predict. But with this financial crisis, we just don't know how to rebuild the financial sector and how to get things back together. And Secretary Geithner, the markets were looking for a plan, and he gave them a concept. And maybe they could have managed the expectations a little better, but either way, there really isn't yet a plan, because even those in Washington don't have a real good handle on what's causing the cumulative financial problems.
Yeah, we went from what in the 90s was called irrational exuberance to irrational pessimism. So it'd be nice if we could stop someplace in between at sort of rational pessimism or rational exuberance. So I think we've gone from wildly optimistic to wildly pessimistic. And the problem is the government needs to and the markets need to convince themselves that we're going back to a normal situation, and that hasn't really happened yet.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a caller. We welcome others. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And this caller is in Indiana on our toll-free line, so we'll talk with them. Line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I must say, economics has changed from when I was in school at IU a while back. I wouldn't hear any of my economist teachers talk as you guys are now because we know everything. I thought perhaps if you could go over the history of where perhaps moments occurred that should have gone another way. I know the wars are causing a lot of trouble in terms of outflow of money. But, God, you must have a better handle on it and just tell us. We don't know what's going on because of the financial situation. Now, is this because, since we've never really been through one like this before, people bring up the 30s all the time, but nobody ever equates anything along the way. And I'm getting very suspicious of economists, and I thought perhaps you could right the ship somewhat. Thank you.
Right. Well, let me start and let Dick amplify what I'll say. And I think, again, this is kind of a confession that we don't like to make, and that is we don't know exactly what happened. It would be nice to tell you a story, and I can tell you a story about what happened, but the story may or may not be actually correct in terms of explaining things. And someone used the analogy that it's a little bit like asking a question, what was the cause of World War One? And you could say, well, it was imperialist powers coming against each other, fighting for markets. It was inevitable we were going to have a war. You could say it was assassination of the Archduke. You could say it was the mobilization of the Russian forces. And probably no one of those things actually caused World War One, but all of them together did. And so you go back here, is it the Chairman Greenspan keeping interest rates too low, the subprime mortgage problem, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, all these things could be the cause, but I think no one of them is the full cause, and that's the place where we are right now, which goes back to my suspicion is we don't really know exactly what the answer is. So I'll let Dick.
Well, I mean, similarly, the 30s have been used as evidence for people espousing different basic philosophies about how the economy works and how it should go together. Supply side economists have used it as evidence for their arguments. Demand side economists, monetary economists. It was a major crisis, mainly financial. My own sense, having taught macroeconomics for a number of years, is that there were with hindsight major mistakes made in monetary policy in the 30s. That we were not going to make again. But the problem is we came to this new financial crisis and we did the things right that with hindsight had been done wrong in the 30s, and there were other things going on too. The bubble, the derivatives, the people buying assets that they didn't really know what they were. It was different, and merely providing liquidity, as important as that was, didn't get it spent.
Right, and in the 30s, basically stabilizing the banks was the major issue, and we failed to do that. This time, the financial markets are much more fluid, and there's not a fine dividing line between what banks do and what other kind of financial organizations do. So we lack the knowledge and lack the ability to deal with these non-bank financial organizations, as Dick was suggesting.
There's also a great metaphor that comes out of thinking about the 30s, and that is that monetary policy alone can't solve a deep crisis of demand. It's like pushing on a string. You can put the liquidity out there, but you can't create the confidence that makes people want to buy new things and hire new people.
Well, one thing I might – the caller said that his economics was outdated now. Actually, it may be just the opposite. I find my economics I took back in the 1960s exactly what they're talking about now in terms of the stimulus package. So it makes me feel like instead of having 30 or 40 years when what I learned in principle seemed to have no particular relevance, it seems now it's very relevant. So it's kind of an odd situation that we're relying on multipliers and stimuluses that haven't been talked about much in macroeconomics for several decades.
Well, is it an oversimplification to say, in response to this question about what happened, that what happened was we had a speculative bubble that was fueled by a runaway real estate market that was out of its head with vastly overvalued property, and eventually it just all came crashing down.
That's exactly right. But Chairman Greenspan, and I think more recently Chairman Bernanke, thought, what's so different about this? We had the same kind of thing happening in the 1990s with the dot-com bubble and the telecommunications and all of those things. And that came crashing down. Enron failed and so on. And they said, well, we handled that. We finessed that. We can finesse the housing crisis. So some people are saying it was a problem not just of lack of knowledge but also a problem of hubris where people had kind of undue pride or confidence in their own ability when that confidence really wasn't well justified.
Yeah. Well, I have another caller here I want to get to just for a second, though, to tie this with Illinois. What we want to make sure that we do, we're going to talk about Illinois problems, our budget situation. I want to make sure we do that. But I think just one point that you all make in the writing that you did for the report, this is not just an Illinois problem. It's a world problem, and we're in it just like everybody else is in it.
Right. Usually when I talk about the Illinois economy, I talk about what's special about Illinois, our exports or our growth in this industry or that industry or how Caterpillar is doing or whatever. But basically, I think we're along for the ride now. The economy in Illinois is obviously going to go the same way as the U.S. and the world economy, and that's where we are right now. There's nothing particularly special about Illinois. We didn't have an unusually high number of foreclosures. We weren't overly dependent on the automobile industry. These things together didn't really cause it in Illinois. We're just sort of going along with the flow here.
And in fact, if you talk about those things, that there are certainly other places where they're much worse off, foreclosures, right. Much, you know, Texas, Florida, other places where – or in other places where they depend very heavily on heavy industry for their economy.
Right.
So in some respects, we don't have those. The problems that we have, we have them, but they're not as acute as they are.
Right. So my analysis is there's no special story about Illinois as far as the economy. There's a huge and unpleasant story about the government in Illinois and the budget. So that's a different issue.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign next, line one. Hello.
Hi. You know, I think Geithner's taken an awfully heavy amount of unfair criticism. And the reason I say that is, how in the world is he going to be able to actually foretell what the real situation with the banks are when they're not really reporting to us what the real problems are? And you can't even – nobody can be sure of the solvency of General Electric right now, our number one corporation in the country outside the oil companies, and nobody even knows for sure whether General Electric's solvent because of all their loan problems. So – with all the intricacies and all the problems that we have in our economy right now, whatever he thinks is appropriate to do with the banks today, it's a good chance this is more like the Super Bowl. A couple of fumbles or a couple of unexpected events, and all of a sudden what was appropriate for today is going to be totally inappropriate for the middle of the summer or for October or November.
Mm-hmm. You want
to? Well, that's to a certain extent right. I don't have any opinion about GE, but things certainly change, and we don't have a game plan that works. It's not like you pull out a blueprint from the drawer and say this is the way you recapitalize the system. You don't study that in graduate school. You don't do that in everyday policymaking kind of operations. But if you'd asked me a year ago, who would you like to be in charge, I would have chosen Ben Bernanke. He probably knows more about the Great Depression than anyone else. And Secretary Geithner has certainly acquitted himself well in the past. So I don't think they're unskilled people. It's just, as you suggest, a very difficult kind of problem to deal with where there's no easy answer, and the answer is not easy. We don't even have a kind of plan that you can draw on. It's sort of an ad hoc thing. So they're often criticized for changing their mind, but I think they're changing their mind because conditions are changing.
No, I agree. I mean, I wouldn't want to have his job because of the incredible difficulty and uncertainty that goes with it. You know, so faulting him on something is really like everybody else acting on our hope that somebody is going to come along with magic and solve these problems. Obama ain't going to do it, and Geithner ain't going to do it. Because we don't even know what it is.
And also, you might be sort of surprised, but there's actually very little difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration in how they're dealing with this. Some of the same personnel are there. Many of the same policies are in place. So aside from the stimulus package, it's sort of business as usual in trying to deal with the crisis.
In terms of the financial management.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank the caller for the question. Just for a moment to talk about the economic stimulus package, do you have some sort of idea what specifically that might mean for the state of Illinois and the Illinois economy? Professor Dye, do you have a thought about that?
I have not worked through the package itself. I'm very concerned about the stimulus package. Not that there shouldn't be one. It goes back to the previous caller. Something's got to be done, but we don't really know how to do it best. But it's a lot easier for me to see the things that I would disagree with or be concerned about. And there are three. One, a lot of this spending is not going to happen fast. And back in the 60s, when Fred and I were learning about and then teaching fiscal stimulus, there was an awful lot of attention paid to how fast does it get spent. And we've got things that aren't going to be spent. Think of these capital projects where we don't even have plans. The spending isn't going to be done even in the next 18 months. Secondly, I was very disappointed that the president let Congress have so much sway as to the stimulus package, because we got from both sides of the aisle things in it that don't belong in a stimulus package. Social programs that the need for which will continue past the next 18 months, and tax cuts, the expectation for which will continue past the next 18 months. So we've got things in the package that aren't short-term, that aren't targeted and transparent. And so it's easy to criticize, but how would I have done it? I don't know.
Yeah. If you I don't think there's ever been an exact poll, but if you looked at how economists view the stimulus package, I would say that probably one-third of economists say it's basically a bad idea in principle. We shouldn't do it, and it's going to be counterproductive. Probably two-thirds of economists say the stimulus package is a good idea, but within that two-thirds, half of those people probably say that the existing one is not the right one. And maybe only a third of people think that we need a stimulus package, and the one we got is what we actually need to have. So there is a lot of dissension here about what the right policy is.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another caller. Champaign County next, line two. Hello.
Hi. I don't think Geithner's getting enough of the fair criticism that he's due. He was there setting the table with Paulson for the first part of the so-called TARP. And I think people like Michael Hudson at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, or James Galbraith at UT, son of John Kenneth, have scathing critiques of the process and Galbraith. And they are some of the same people that are around. But I actually wanted to talk about Illinois revenues. And I wonder whether you guys can actually quote to me how much corporations are paying, because I don't have a contemporary figure on this, but I found an article that was published only, as far as I can tell, in small journals around the state of Illinois by a guy out of Peoria, out of Springfield. But most of the Fortune 500 that are in here in Illinois have not paid any corporate taxes at all. And one of the things I lay at the previous governor's egoistic approach to things is the way he totally dumped this gross receipts tax idea without doing any advanced preparation. I don't think it's an idea that should be dismissed out of hand. We have the problem of the proportion that regulates the personal versus corporate income tax, and then the overwhelming fact that corporations don't pay any tax in Illinois to speak of anyway. There must be another way to get at it. And people say, well, they're going to move away. Well, they can't move away in a lot of circumstances. And poor corporations, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that corporations had a problem with too much cash on hand. They didn't know what to do with it. And I don't know if they burnt it all up in these fictitious structural investment vehicles and all this garbage that that's around that they don't even know where the titles are. I mean, I thought that was the basic law of real estate, but I guess if you're playing hot potato with the stuff. Anyway, that's quite a rant, isn't it?
Well, there's a hope on many people's part, including former Governor Blagojevich, that someone other than people can pay the tax that we have to pay. And the problem is that there's no way to do that. And simply taxing corporations is not a way to avoid taxing people. It has consequences. And further,
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt because I hear that all the time. And there is a, you know, if they're really competing, they're. There are stockholders that are involved as well. It's not just the people. It's how much they pay out in dividends. And it isn't as simple as they will pass it all on.
No, I didn't say they pass it all on. Some of them may come out of profits. Some of them may come out of wages. Some of them may come out of higher salaries. You'd probably like to have it all come out of profits, which might happen. But that also has the potential of driving, as you dismissed, driving people out of the state. The point is that whether you're talking about the federal government or the state government, corporate taxes are going to make up a small but significant part of revenues. The big ticket items are going to remain the sales tax and the income tax, and there's no way to avoid that as much as you might like.
Can you quote me how much sales corporate tax has actually been paid in the state of Illinois?
Well, around $1 billion a year out of a $8 or $9 billion budget, $10 billion budget. So, or even larger than that now. So probably about less than 10%. Probably more like 7% or so of payments. So it's small and it's declining. It's declining at the federal level. It's declining at the state level. Right now, it's declining because of cyclical reasons. But over the long term, it's been declining because corporations have found ways, as you won't be surprised to learn, to avoid the tax. They end up forming non-corporate entities that don't pay the tax. A whole variety of things are used. And it seems like the tax planners are always one step ahead of the tax collectors in this regard, and we haven't really been able to catch up. So I think you might want to find a way to put a heavier burden on corporations. That's not going to solve the state of Illinois' problem. The state of Illinois' problem is that we have expenditures that are far out of line with our revenues, and it's going to have to come out of the real sources of revenue, which are the income tax and the sales tax.
I want to get Professor Dian here. This is something that I really wanted to make sure we talked about. This is something that you write about in the Illinois Report, and that is this huge discrepancy between what we bring in and what we spend. And we've been doing this now in the state of Illinois, I think, for quite a few years. I seem to actually even recall having talked with Professor Gertz here back when Governor Ryan was in office. We had this conversation at that point. Where do we stand here now with revenues and expenditures, and what options do we have to try and get things more in line?
Well, the first part of the question, of course, is easier, the problem rather than the solution. We're in a mess. We have a structural deficit, an underlying mismatch between what's coming in and what's going out. We're in a very severe cyclical deficit, which is exacerbating the problems we have. Over the last, six, but make it longer. You could include other governors in this. When revenues have perked up, we've obligated those to current programs. So rather than get our fiscal house in order, we ratcheted up the expectation for government spending. And worse, if you look out 20 years to when people will be retired and obligations for pensions will become due and obligations for retiree health care will become due, that aging of the U.S. population is going to have a very big effect on state and local governments. So we've got everything working against us. We've made bad decisions over recent years, always pushing costs into the future, revenues and revenues into the present, ratcheting things up. We failed to react to the underlying mismatch in either how much should we tax or how much should we spend, and we don't see the iceberg coming. That is the aging of the population and what that means for healthcare costs and declining wage income tax revenues. So we can talk about what the current problem is, but it's all those things. It's cyclical, structural, and cyclical, secular. So the controller has got some pretty good estimates of where we are when you add all of the current things together, and that's in a hole that what's the 2-year number, Fred?
Well, it's four and a half for this year. If you add next year, it's probably 9.
Yeah, so it's 9 for a 2-year amount, and if all of this year's amount gets rolled into next year. And that's one of the ways we've always balanced the budget in Illinois, is that we have pushed costs into the next budget year and said, "Well, we'll figure it out then." So I haven't quantified any of these things, but we're in real trouble.
And Governor Blagojevich has a lot to answer for, and I actually wrote an article saying that his ethical failings were probably second to his policy failings in terms of what he's done to the state budget. But I think you can't dismiss the role of the General Assembly. Last year, when we passed the budget for 2009, back in May of last year, the General Assembly sent the governor a budget that was $1.5 billion out of balance. They were spending $1.5 billion more than they expected to take in revenue, which is probably unconstitutional, but they did it nevertheless. And they sent that on to the governor that they didn't trust and they thought was dishonest to resolve the situation. So we had $1.5 billion built into the budget of deficit. In addition to that, we had $1.5 billion or $2 billion of late payments, largely to health care providers. And then the bad news came in terms of the recession, and we've lost $1 billion of expected revenue. So that's how you get to the $4 or $5 billion figure for this year.
Just real quick, and we're already past the midpoint. I got a bunch of callers I want to get to. I just want to come back to. I certainly heard the frustration of the other caller raising the question about corporate tax,
right,
and whether whether or not that would solve all of our problems. He seemed to be saying that there's something fundamentally wrong with corporations paying nothing.
Right.
Is that something that we can address? And certainly, I would think that it would help. So it would help somewhat. It wouldn't solve all of our problems, maybe, but would that not help?
There's a long story that we don't want to tell today, but economists aren't particularly enamored, liberal or conservative, with the corporate tax or other ways to tax businesses that are preferable. But given that we have it, we could do a better job of making it uniform and enforcing the rules and so on. Mm-hmm. And that being said, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. It's kind of like at the federal government, we used to worry about $1 billion. Now, who cares about 5 or 10 or $50 billion when we're talking about a $1 trillion deficit? Well, in the state of Illinois, we might be able to pick up $200 or $300 million if we had a really aggressive corporate tax enforcement operation. But that's only going to be a very small part of our problem.
We got $9 billion deficit.
Yeah, so you have to actually go back. I mean, Dick said the answer is hard. Actually, the answer is easy for me as a non-politician. You either have to find more revenues or find a way to rein in spending. Yeah. So that's easy for me to say. It's difficult for the politicians to do that.
Well, unless you're going to shut down state government, aren't we really forced actually to say, well, really cutting spending is not exactly an option, and that really what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to raise revenue? And then you get to this question, well, okay, how do you do that without increasing taxes? Well, you don't.
Right. No, that's right. And I think there are ways. You don't really cut spending, but you cut the rate of growth of spending. What Governor Blagojevich was very adroit at doing was to start new programs with no funding, but build an entitlement. And then in future years, those entitlements are obligations of the state. So we need to do things like that to try to not necessarily make the government smaller, but make it grow less rapidly. And obviously involves some pain. It probably means not as much money for education as a lot of people would like, not having universal health care, a whole host of things that are in and of themselves seem like good ideas. But when it comes to the question of are they good ideas when you have to pay for them, then I think it's a different kind of calculus.
I've always told my students that any one of us can balance the budget, probably with some compromise, any two of us. But then you get past that and you really get into, whose ox is being gored and the political consensus becoming very, very difficult. I understand the frustration of liberals with corporations not paying what they perceive as their what they, the liberals, and I include myself in that, consider as a fair share. But it's very difficult to tax an enterprise that does business in a large number of states. And how do you account for what income is in what state? To go after that is extremely difficult, even with earnest liberal policymakers, but it's a form of denial for liberals to decry corporations not paying their share as a reason not to face the hard situation we're in.
Yeah, and Illinois, we always go, we always look for the easiest solution first. So the first line of defense is raise the cigarette tax, and the second line of defense is expand gambling, and the third line of defense is close corporate loopholes. And all of those we've done in a certain degree, but they simply don't raise enough money to deal with the problem.
And the caller that was again wanting to go at corporations found the gross receipts tax as a possibly attractive way of doing that. I see the gross receipts tax as a tax on consumers. That it would stick on corporations is something maybe the caller and Blagojevich believed, but that's naive to a fault in my view. It may be on the capitalists who own the corporation, but it also may be on the consumers of the product of that corporation or the workers of that corporation. And it's certainly not obvious that labeling it a corporate tax makes it a corporate tax.
We have two guests with us on the program this morning. Here in the studio with me is Fred Gertz, and talking on the telephone is Richard Dye. They're both economists at the University of Illinois. Fred, right at the moment, is heading the Department of Economics. They are both also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and have contributed to the Illinois Report 2009 that looks at a number of subjects, the economy being one. And if you're interested in reading it, you can either get a copy or read it online if you go to the website of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Some other callers here. We'll get next to somebody in Champaign, and this would be line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I ran across an interesting blog entry today that I wanted to get your guest's reaction to. It's a guest post on Danny Roderick's weblog. He's a well-known development economist at Harvard. And his guest was Kevin Gallagher, who's an economist professor at Boston University, and he put together just basically a roundup of all of the corporate the stimulus packages around the world. And when you look at it, it's really pretty small potatoes. The sum of the packages looks to be about $3 trillion, which is 0.5% of global GDP. And if you're taking, the Keynesian stimulus seriously, that, government has to step in and make up the demand shortfall from the private sector, that's really not anywhere near the amount that's already been lost. And also in regard to that, there's a wide variety of different types of packages that different countries are putting forward. Some are focusing on infrastructure and spending and tax cuts like we are. Others, other people, have more pressing fires to put out and are trying to, keep their currency from, becoming worthless. And so I wanted to get your guest's impression, have we done enough, worldwide to stench the bloodletting at this point? And it sort of raises larger questions for me that I've wondered about this for a long time. When you have economic globalization all over the world without the political structures growing in tandem with them in order to provide the oversight and the taxation and the monetary policy as a harmonious in conjunction with the growing interconnectedness between nations. If you don't have some sort of a body overseeing that in order to make sure that those corporations taking advantage of the global trade aren't rushing, to more favorable locales or doing economic transactions that are going to have this contagious effect that we've seen that take everyone down with them. Is economic globalization without political globalization really a very good idea? So that's a big question, and I'll hang up and take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right.
Let me address the first one. I'll leave the harder part to Dick, maybe. I think you're possibly confusing asset values with the national income. Obviously, there's been a huge decline in asset values around the world and in the United States because of the decline in the stock market and the collapse of housing bonds and things of that sort. And again, the size of the stimulus compared to the loss of asset value is relatively small. But I think the appropriate comparison is the amount of the stimulus compared to the expected decline in GDP. And the expected decline of GDP is only a few percentage points. So that is fairly large compared to that. So I think a lot of people, again, it's hard to be optimistic about much of anything right now. But I think if you ask the typical person on the street what's happened to the economy, they'd say, well, we're probably down 20-30% from last year in terms of what's going on. All these people are losing their jobs and businesses are failing and things of that sort. But actually, the decline in GDP is probably 2-3 or 4% at this point, which is much smaller than most people would imagine. So the stimulus package may have some fairly powerful impact on that if it works.
Yeah, there's a rule of thumb relating the increase in the unemployment rate to the output gap, and I don't know what it is currently. Only that I taught it in previous years. But think of multiplying if the unemployment rate goes from 6 to 8%. Think of multiplying that by 1.5. So a 2% extra unemployment is 3% of lost output. I might be wrong on that, but that's the order of magnitude that should be looked at and that Fred is talking about.
Okay. Well, just I wonder, though, just to go back to and I'm not sure if this is what the caller was asking, but just go back to a very, very basic question, that and this goes to the criticism some people have made of the stimulus plan. Those people have said, it's not enough. It's not big enough. Is it? I mean, is it big enough to really make a difference?
Well, it's certainly big enough to make a difference. Even last year, I think people think that the smaller stimulus package, which in retrospect wasn't the tax rebates weren't really spent to a large degree, had a lot of people think at least a 1 or 1.5% impact on GDP temporarily. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to have an impact. And the question, again, I don't have the answer, which I'm not a macroeconomist, even if I were, I don't think I'd know exactly what the answer is. But if you're saying that the stimulus package may not be a good idea, then you say, well, why not double it? That's not necessarily a good approach either, because a stimulus package isn't supposed to have a long-term impact in terms of making the economy grow. A stimulus package is supposed to stimulate at some point and then stop stimulating later. It's supposed to change the time path of the economy, and it seems like this is, in fact, a pretty big one, and getting bigger now is probably not a good idea until we actually know better how this works.
Okay.
So the actual decline in demand so far has been modest, but the concern is that that's going to compound because of the financial crisis and the crisis of confidence. If everybody stops spending, then this could be too small. So I'm not entering the debate as to whether the stimulus package is too big or too small, but that's where the people who think it's too small, they're concerned that we're not going to get the financial act together, and that's going to contribute to a further decline in confidence, and those who stop buying are going to cause others to be out of work and cause them both to lose their jobs and others to lose their confidence, and it's going to be cumulative.
But there's also we're becoming two-armed economists on one hand, on the other hand. On the other hand, there are economists, really distinguished ones, who think there's a roaring inflation on the horizon if we don't somehow rein in the money supply once confidence returns, because we've had a really unprecedented, huge increase in the money supply and in financial liquidity. And once people start to get their confidence back, the problem is not going to be recession. It's going to be inflation. So you have all these problems in the wings, and it's very difficult to deal with one and without thinking about the others as well.
Okay, let's talk with someone else. Effingham here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I have a question and a statement, if I might. All morning on this subject, I've heard nothing but the symptoms of social exploitation, and I have heard no solutions. You have an answer for that?
I think that there obviously, things are being done that would never have been contemplated in the past. If you think about what's happened in the last year or so, we've basically eliminated investment banking in the United States. We have taken over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two major mortgage operations. We've basically taken over one of the biggest insurers in the world. We've had a three-quarters of a trillion-dollar stimulus package and also another bailout package of about the same magnitude. None of these things would have been expected or tolerated a year ago, but the world has changed. So I think that there is, in fact, a real reason to try to stabilize the financial system. I think that, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, a socialist or a libertarian, I think there is a real reason to try to make sure that the financial system doesn't implode. There's, I think, more doubt and more question about the stimulus package, but the underlying stability of the financial system is very, very important. And for good or for ill, whoever caused it, something has to be done about it now.
So your answer is the imperialization, then?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by imperialization, but
I mean that's a standard by which capitalism lives. I mean, it's a historical fact that the big get bigger and the small disappear.
Well, it's going to be just the opposite now. People decried the fact that we had huge amounts of income going to the top 1% of the income distribution. That's not going to happen anymore. Liberals should be
now. Hey. Now that banks now will be imperialized, and there'll be fewer of those, and all of the functions of banks, and the social impact that that has upon the population. I mean, if you've never lived at the bottom of the barrel, brother, I'm telling you what, it ain't comfortable.
You're right, but the problem is
tons of millions of people in this country, a third of the population in this country live in poverty. Around the world, it's probably like 99%.
Well, I mean, you must be living on a different planet, but aside from that, the fact is that low-income people are going to be hurt, and high-income people are going to have their incomes reduced very dramatically. So there's going to be a more equal distribution of income at a lower level, which no one's going to like very much.
Yeah, Professor Dye, you want to comment?
I mean, this question is a much broader premise than I want to engage. I mean, I certainly don't share the speaker's view that our problems are the result of exploitation only. I mean, certainly there were powerful people making choices that had leverage, and that leverage hurt other people too. But it's much more complicated than that.
Well, with apologies to the caller, and with only a couple of minutes here, I want to try to go to somebody else and maybe get one or two more calls in before we're out of time. Next, we'll go to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel laureate economist, said something the other day that was important. He said we shouldn't confuse saving the banks with saving the bankers. And I think, you know, so far we've been trying to save the bankers or trying to save the bank by saving the bankers. But I think you were correct earlier when you said that, you know, we're kind of along for the ride as, Illinois as a state. I think these problems are far bigger than states are individually or just too weak to really address this kind of crisis and turn the economy around. I guess I'm kind of surprised you don't see where the problem comes from. There's been just such a structuring of our economy and our tax laws in a way that give all this power to corporations and to, the very wealthiest people, with everything structured against the rest of us. And we've deregulated things to the point where, the sort of apple cart has been turned over by the greed. But I think, you go back way farther than like Glass-Steagall and those regulations. I think the real problem goes back to when the Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment that gave citizenship to the former slaves as giving citizenship rights and personhood to corporations, and that has given them, so much power that they've been able to completely corrupt our political system so that they can call the shots in terms of how the economy goes, and we don't have much power to change that.
Well, the question you'd have to ask yourself is, did suddenly all these bad things you perceive happening in the economy just start occurring in the last couple of years, and we suddenly had the crisis in 2008. I think
there's systemic. We've been, these other bubbles were, sort of finagled around to put the problem off. I think this has been building for many decades, not just the last few years.
Yeah, one other comment, too. Maybe surprising to you and other people, bankers have not come away very happy from this affair. Most financial organizations have had trauma, have lost almost all of their equity. Look at the banking stocks. You have stocks that were $70 or $80 now down to a dollar or two, basically penny stocks. And the people who own the banks basically have been wiped out. And people who own Lehman Brothers, they're basically nowhere. So we haven't protected the owners, and to a certain extent, we tried to protect the customers of these organizations. So it's not something that that we have not necessarily bailed out the individuals. We tried to bail out the banks, and only partially with success.
Professor Dai, you want to comment?
There are villains in this piece, and there are opportunities missed to regulate responsibly. That you can replay the last years of history and do things a lot better with hindsight. But I think it is simplistic to think that it's all about power, and if only there were a different social order that constrained that particular power, that all would be okay. I don't get comfort from that kind of simplification.
We're coming, and my apologies, we have some people can't take. We're essentially down to having about a minute. I get in, get into this discussion about who controls the economy, people will have very different ideas. I guess as a question to finish up, though, my question would be, where we are now, what has this done to the belief, if one ever had the belief, that the government had the power to regulate the economy?
Well, I think there's been a crisis in both ways. I used to think the economy was inherently stable and didn't need a lot of regulation, and people would adjust and so on. That clearly is not the case. I also believed, as many people believed, that there was it's called the period of great moderation, where we thought monetary authorities had a great deal of knowledge and were able to fine-tune things, and that's not correct. So I think I've lost some faith in the market, at least in certain ways, and I've lost some faith in regulation. So I think I still think the market's the way to go in most cases, but I think we do need to have a rethinking of where we are.
Yeah. Professor Dai, what do you think?
I think that Alan Greenspan, with his libertarian urges, failed to see this bubble coming and the opportunities for proper regulation. I think Phil Graham is certainly a villain in this piece, but with the complicity of President Clinton in not regulating some of these financial, call them innovations, that allowed the bubble and misinformation about what financial assets really were to happen. But here we are. I could spend my time naming and blaming bad guys in this piece, but we are all in this boat right now.
Well, there we will have to leave it with our thanks to our guests. Richard Dai, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Fred Gertz here with the studio.
Thank you.
Both of them are economists at the University of Illinois. Both have contributed to the Illinois Report 2009. If you'd like to look at that, you can see it online or you can get a hard copy. Just go to the website of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. They're both affiliated with the Institute. And the report for 2009 looks at a number of subjects, things like the economy, but also education, child care, infrastructure, some interesting things there. So you can take a look at that. And with that, I guess we'll say, well, that's it for us here on Focus 580. But, of course, we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up in the way of news, features, sports, weather, other sorts of things. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be film historian and critic David Thompson. We will talk with him about the movies this afternoon. He's got two new books out. One is a guide to 1,000 movies from A to Z. It's called Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. He is also the author recently of a memoir, Try to Tell the Story. David Thompson will be our guest this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. Let's take a look at commodity prices. March wheat in Kansas City is trading at 564. That contract is off 2. May 569, down 5. March wheat in Chicago, 522 and a quarter, down 2.5. May, 532, down 3.75. March corn, 363.5, down 1/4. May, 372 and a quarter, unchanged. July, 382, unchanged. September, 391.5, up 3/4. March beans, 868.5, down 9.5. May, 867.5, down 12.5. July, 873.5, down 11.5. August, 886, up 9. March soybean meal, 268 even, down 480. March oil, 3160, down 30. At the Merck in Chicago, February live cattle, 8255, up 60. April, 8555, up 70. March feeder cattle, 9180, up 120. April, 9270, up 112.5. And April lean hogs, 5895. That kind.